Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to New Books in Gender Studies. My name is Shohini Chatterjee, and I'm a PhD student in Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at Western University, and I'm absolutely delighted to be in conversation today with Dr. Seema Shaksari on their new book entitled Politics of Rightful Killing, Civil Society, Gender, and Sexuality in Weblogistan, published by Duke University Press in 2020. Dr. Shaksari is Associate Professor of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at the University of Minnesota. Welcome to the New Books Network, Seema.
Thank you so much, Shohini. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. Could you begin by telling us how you came to blogging and Weblogistan, the Iranian blogosphere in particular, in the early 2000s when the internet looked very different and the so-called war on terror was underway? How did it lead you to research and talk about blogging as a mode of cyber activism, which also then translated into finding community and belonging when war, security and surveillance created anxieties around notions of both community as well as belonging?
Sure. So I was a grad student, like yourself, when I was doing my research, and I had done my master's degree in at San Francisco State at the time in gender and women's studies, and my research was on the discursive production of Iranian queer diaspora. So I was already interested in politics of diaspora and gender and sexuality. And when I started my PhD program, I wanted to expand on that and continue, and I became very interested in the politics of satellite television programs that were produced in Los Angeles and broadcast to Iran. And this was at the onset of the so-called war on terror, when I saw a lot of, you know, these programs where all of them, which were mostly entertainment, had become political, and they were very much, there were anchors sitting there and just talking about a regime change in Iran and a revolution happening in Iran. And this was basically when the student protests were happening in Iran at the time. President Khatami was the Iranian president, and the Iranian diaspora, the opposition, the Iranian diaspora, were appropriating these protests as regime change protests, whereas they were really about privatization. Students were protesting the privatization. And, of course, the Iranian intelligence had a very severe crackdown on students, and Iranian diaspora took this and basically went off with it. And this is, you know, I became really interested in the way that masculinity was deployed in these forms of kind of appropriation by these television programs, where they were kind of saying stuff like, let me sacrifice myself for your manhood and this and that. So that's when I became interested in Iranian satellite television programs and the politics of homeland and notions of gender and masculinity. And heteronormativity. So I went to Turkey because I can't go to Iran. I went to Turkey to talk to Iranians who traveled between Iran and Turkey because there are no visa requirements, to talk to them about how they receive these satellite television programs. And this was, you know, again, like I said, at the onset of war on terror, Condoleezza Rice had promised somewhere like $70 million of budget for regime change purposes in Iran and propaganda. And all these satellite television programs in Los Angeles were kind of competing over this money. They were assuming that if they showed that they were very much about regime change and, you know, notions of freedom and democracy in Iran, they would receive this funding. At the end of the day, the funding actually was used by the U.S. Department of State to start the Voice of America in Persian television program. Voice of America is a post-World War, basically Cold War, the media, the propaganda wing of the U.S. state. And so the money went to there. But before then, all these satellite television programs were fighting over, you know, kind of who's going to get this money and all that. So when I went to Turkey to talk to people about how they receive these programs, people were like, what are you talking about? We don't watch these programs. It's trash. And one Iranian woman, young Iranian woman in particular, told me, you know, Iranian satellite televisions that come from L.A., don't need to be researched. They need to be boycotted. In Farsi, she said, kind of rhymed and said, "Tahqiq nadaran, tahrim daran." So she told me, you know, I should be really looking at blogs. That's where young Iranians are kind of having more serious conversations. And then I also, at the same time, I noticed this proliferation of this kind of news coverage in international media about Persian blogging and how so many Iranians, in particular Iranian women, are using blogs and how blogs are setting Iranians free, how they're giving Iranian women a voice. Literally, that was the title of an article, or, you know, freedom will be blogged, and so on and so forth. So I became interested in the politics of blogging. And that's when I started to blog myself. Kind of first for a while, I lurked to kind of see what was happening. Then I started my own blog and blogged for a year before. And basically did online ethnography. I announced to bloggers, Iranian bloggers, who were writing mostly about the politics of Iran. That's, you know, at that point there were 100,000 Iranian bloggers by around 2005. So I started blogging, and kind of through snowballing, I got to learn about other blogs, you know, in the blog roles and all that. And some bloggers mm-hmm. gave me links. So I became kind of a popular blogger at that time in Farsi. Of course, I was blogging in Farsi or Persian. And then after doing blogging for a year or so, I went to Toronto, where a lot of Iranian or influential Iranian bloggers lived at the time, to do also offline ethnography. I'm sorry about that long answer, but, you know, just, you know, for you to know how I became interested in blogging. And that is when, you know, I also noticed that because really the first bloggers in Persian started soon after September 11, 2001. And it's not really a coincidence. One of the, first Persian bloggers, perhaps the second one, first one, Salman Jaberi, second one was Hossein Derakhshan. He basically said that he started Persian blogging and encouraged others and started a template on Blogger in Persian to encourage other people other Iranians to blog to kind of defy the stereotypes about Iranians that were very much produced, not just after September 11. Of course, it goes back to the Iranian Revolution, but in particular after September 11. So his idea was to kind of show a different image of Iranianness to the world. And also, you know, he was interested in, at that time, in creating bridges between Iranians in Iran and the U.S., and also what he called a window through which the U.S. can look at Iran. So I talk about that in my book, but and also a cafe, a kind of a site of civil society. That those are the words that he used when he started popularizing Persian blogging. So, and of course, it was through blogging that many Iranian bloggers kind of found a sense of community online, and these notions of community, while being very attractive, as I argue in the book, were also sites of violence and also reiteration of forms of nationalism that were reproduced in online spaces.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was going through the chapters, and they were thought-provoking in many ways. I was thinking particularly about the concept of neoliberal digital citizenship, which you explore in your book. I was wondering if you could reflect on how this kind of citizenship interferes with blogging as an exercise in freedom.
I don't see it as interfering, because if you think about the neoliberal logic, it is very much about the idea of freedom, right? So the notion of free market is supposed to trickle down and trickle down to the social realm, and the idea is that through free market and the logic of global capitalism, social freedoms will just flow, transnationally. So the idea of neoliberalism was very much, you know, ideas of individualism and individual freedom were very much prevalent in weblogistan. And it is exactly those notions of freedom that I write about, how ideas of blogging, granting freedom to Iranians who are supposed to be trapped in a big jail, and also notions of neoliberal self-entrepreneurship that I write about in the book, about how certain diasporic Iranian bloggers tapped in to opportunities provided during the war on terror to basically become what I call, using Foucault, the homo economicus, basically the economic man who is very much self-responsible in the context of the war on terror and Iranian diaspora in North America and Europe, for many Iranian bloggers who had recently come from Iran and did not have many job opportunities and were facing discrimination, blogging, in a sense, and tapping into opportunities that were provided by propaganda regimes, by the U.S. Department of State or by Dutch Parliament and, all these other so-called democratizing states, they tapped into these bloggers tapped into these opportunities to make a living, and at the same time produce and reproduce these notions of freedom that are inevitably connected to notions of securitization. Of course, again, as Foucault says, there is no freedom without security. So the idea of individual freedom, as I show in the book, is very much connected to increased securitization and the forms of securitization in the name of freedom, whether it is militarization in the Middle East or whether it is internet securitization, granting access to Iranian internet users through proxies, how the U.S. state contracted companies like Anonymizer to basically provide filter breakers or proxies to Iranian internet users to circumvent the Iranian state's filtering while imposing its own filtering and censorship. So, you know, the example that I bring, which is a funny one, is how in the beginning when the U.S. contracted with these private companies such as Anonymizer to send proxies to Iranian internet users through human rights organizations that are all about freedom and democracy and so on and so forth, they filtered the word ASS, because they wanted to prevent Iranian internet users from surfing the internet for gay porn. And interestingly, they realized soon after that any word that contained the letters ASS would be blocked, including American embassy. So, you know, that's kind of the comical part of this securitization process on the internet in the name of freedom. So I'm kind of going on tangents, but excuse me, I should probably drink some water. But this is, you know, one example of how notions of freedom and security come into an uncomfortable kind of tension.
You write that Weblogistan was widely regarded as a site where free speech could be practiced, and that it was a virtual rehearsal for democracy in a way, where Iranian women who were thought to have been silent could claim their space. However, Weblogistan did not fulfill its promise because of the very nature of politics in America as well as Iran. Could you tell us what this unfulfilled promise reveals about the interconnection between global and local politics and its gendered sort of implications?
Sure. So, you know, again, a lot of the news coverage about Weblogistan was about blogging freeing Iranian women or Iranian population in general and Iranian women in particular. And, you know, so from outside, one could assume that first, Iranian women did not have a voice prior to the emergence of Weblogistan, which is, as I argue in the book, a false assumption, and second, that Weblogistan was the realm of freedom of speech, which again, as I show through these ethnographic accounts online, that wasn't necessarily the case, because so much censorship was happening in these online conversations through the gendered notions of honor and also, you know, the kind of slut-shaming that would happen of many Iranian feminists, and the kind of reproduction of nationalist discourses and the masculinist kind of notions of Iranian-ness that would basically you know, try to silence Iranian feminists for embarrassing, you know, a whole nation. Or, you know, the other side of it would be the opposition groups that were trying to instrumentalize Iranian feminists and kind of in the name of freeing women pushing their own agendas. So this kind of the global politics or the national and transnational politics that you asked about is very much, you know, playing out in the examples that I bring in the blogosphere, where Iranian women feminists, whether it comes to talking about attending soccer games in the Azadi Stadium in Iran, or their protests before the presidential elections, how they're stuck between a hard and a rock place, a rock and a hard place, where, you know, they either have to respond to the male nationalist male elites who basically say this is not the time, or these are not the issues of the Iranian nation, on one hand, and then on the other hand, the opposition groups who would basically consider any kind of political participation in the Iranian politics by Iranian women to be a form of collusion with the state, with the Islamic Republic. So it is between that kind of national politics and the transnational politics of democratization and, you know, basically interventions by the U.S. that the Iranian women feminists had to negotiate and to navigate basically the way that they talked about gender and, you know, politics.
Mm-hmm. I also was hoping to understand how weblogistan became a site of governmentality and how desiring subjects were normalized, as you write, according to neoliberal and nationalist discourses. Could you expand on the relationship between neoliberal governmentality and the impetus to normalize desiring subjects as exceptional digital Iranian citizens?
Sure. You know, as you know, in the book, I talk about governmentality in the Foucauldian sense, which is basically going beyond the government of the population by the state, that we are talking about basically governmentalization of state rather than statization of the government, which basically means that the notion of governing a population goes beyond the realm of the state, whether it's the Iranian state or the U.S. or whatnot, but we are talking about the participation of the individuals themselves in the realm of civil society. So basically, you know, that is how I kind of think about cyber governmentality, wherein civil society becomes very much a part and parcel of governmentality. That is, civil society becomes a site where the individual is normalized, in a sense, the conduct of the individual is normalized. And again, if we go back to the kind of concept of governmentality, while we are talking about a form of kind of in a sense a nexus of discourses and individuals and practices that focus on the individual, but or kind of, you know, the exertion of power or the operations of power that focus on the individual, but have as their goal the normalization of population. So in cyberspace, or in, you know, weblogistan in this particular case, I'm talking about how it is through these practices of blogging, through basically participation of individuals who are focusing very much about, you know, how to conduct their own conduct and the conduct of others, to normalize a particular kind of Iranianness. And that particular form of Iranianness brings together the kind of very much heteronormative and gendered notions of Iranianness together with these ideas of democracy and neoliberal, of course, notions of democracy and freedom, to produce an ideal type of Iranianness that is very much classed in a particular way, raced in a particular way, the proximity to whiteness that I discuss in the book, and is very much, you know, heteronormative and very much sanitized. I mean, even if later there were discussions about queerness or homosexuality, as it was discussed in Weblogistan, it was a very much a sanitized form of being a homosexual that fit within the logic of global capitalism, Iranian nationalism, and so on and so forth. So that is what I mean by the notion of cyber-governmentality in Weblogistan, the way that through the proliferation of discourses of democracy and freedom and nationalism and practices where, as I say, bloggers try to conduct their own conduct to fit into this ideal of Iranianness, that not just bloggers, but the whole population at large, the Iranian population, is supposed to be normalized according to these ideal notions of Iranianness.
There's so much in your book that's invaluable and critical. You write that Iranians are seen as those who can be normalized and be led on the path to democracy and neoliberal freedoms, as seen by key players in the West. But they're still regarded as disposable by virtue of being seen as threats and risky citizens as well. Could you tell us about the figuration of the risky citizen and how it relates to not just security, but also global capitalism? And how do you think this complicates one's relationship with the cyberspace?
Sure. So, this goes back to the concept of rightful killing, which is the title of the book. And by that, I kind of try to think about the Iranian population as that which is neither, kind of killable or disposable because the Iranian population is kind of stripped of rights. So neither the kind of bare life nor the kind of population that is seen worthy of living and whose life is worth cultivating through biopolitics. So, but it's at the same time both, because, and that is what I mean by the risky citizens. Here you have Iranians who basically are neither, for example, like Palestinian population, who are reduced to, in a sense, bare life, nor are the kind of population whose life is protecting. But it is exactly through the discourses of democratization that there is, according to this kind of, discourses of freedom and democratization, there's a potential for the Iranian population to become democratic. That's why you hear, for example, many U.S. politicians talking about protecting the rights of the Iranian population and democratization of Iran and so on and so forth. And at the same time, the Iranian population poses a risk to the so-called our way of life or to the international community because how fear of terrorism is attached to Iranianness. And we see that, as I discuss in the book, through policies, immigration policies, through all the sanctions and all that. So on one hand, the Iranian population is seen as apt for democratization. And at the same time, on the other hand, the Iranian population is subjected to kind of pending death through sanctions. I write about the sanctions in this book and how practically since the Iranian Revolution, there have been sanctions imposed on Iran And in different times, they have basically become more and more strict, in particular during Obama's presidency. What he called crippling sanctions basically devastated the Iranian population and inhibited life-saving medicine from going to Iran. You know, the equipment for chemotherapy machines could not be purchased. And then, you know, we had the JCPOA, the so-called Iran deal. There was temporary relief for some time, and then Trump came to power, and then again, those sanctions were reinstalled and worsened in a sense, and they continue to be that way under Biden. So the Iranian population is really dying slowly, to borrow from Lauren Berlant's notion of slow death. You have basically through sanctions, and it's not so slowly, I call this soft killing in the book, which is kind of, you know, in the name of rights, killing the Iranian population softly, because Iranian population in particular under COVID has been dying in really fast rates, and that is exactly because of the lack of access to medicine or medical equipment. And even if on paper it appears that medicine is exempt, it's not. There is a limited number of basically vaccines or medicine that can go to Iran, which is not nearly enough for the 84 million population. And even with that limited number, because the transactions have to happen through these financial institutions that will be penalized if they have any kind of transaction with Iran, no pharmaceutical company is willing to basically sell Iran medicine. So you have a crisis there where where Iranians are dying. And the sanctions are seemingly in the name of protection of the international community or the rights of the Iranian people. So it is, you know, the kind of situation where the Iranian population is dying in the name of rights, you know, in the name of the protection of human rights. And that is basically what I call the kind of politics of rightful killing. And going back to the notion of risky citizens, Iranians are seen as those who inherently carry the risk of terrorism, a risk, but at the same time, they are seen as those who have the potential for democratization.
Mm-hmm. If we gender the figure of the risky citizen, then the figure of the Iranian woman protester, who is hyper-visible in liberationist discourses, comes to the fore, who is seen as a threat to the security of the international community. How do you think Iranian women have navigated this reality? And how has their activism drawn meaning from their varied negotiations with the state, the diaspora, and with Weblogistan as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, you know, as you said, the notion of risky citizen, and when it comes to Iranian women's activism, becomes also very tricky, because on one hand, you have people from, McCain to Trump advocating for the rights of Iranian women when it came to the street protests of Girls of the Revolution Street, or the appropriation of Iranian women's movements in Iran or activism in Iran by opportunistic entrepreneurs, diasporic entrepreneurs such as Masih Alinejad, who has claimed herself to be the representative of Iranian women's movement. Again, you know, appropriations that I talked about before. You basically have this situation where the Iranian women, again, are seen as those who are victims, who are kind of, as I using Paul Emmer's notion of parahuman as parahuman, who are these vulnerable subjects who are at the same time villains, you know. So it's you have to both protect them in a sense as victims, or protect the population or the international community from them. So this notion of risky citizen that I talked about before, when it comes to Iranian women, you know, it comes together with the good old colonial concepts of saving the native women from their men, in a sense. And Iranian women have been negotiating this or navigating this for decades now in Iran. This is not something new, of course. And they continue to do their work. Of course, it's not easy, and it becomes even more difficult when Iranian women are both criminalized by Iranian women activists by the Iranian state, and on the other side, their cause is appropriated by you know, the imperialist kind of agendas and the militaristic agendas of the U.S. and the opportunistic Iranian diaspora. So it's, I think Iranian women have, Iranian women activists have been practicing these kinds of politics through their active participation in the realm of the Iranian, you know, political process, or in the realms that are not reducible to what is seen through the lens of this kind of colonial feminism, you know, just with this fetishization of hijab. There are many other issues that the Iranian women in Iran are dealing with, economic issues to be the foremost concern for working class women, and you know, and the family laws and so on and so forth, rights to inheritance, custody, child custody, and divorce, and so on and so forth, that the Iranian women have been working on. And even, you know, as I say in the book, people like Azam Talabani, who some people see as you know, Islamic fundamentalists, have been some of the most vocal figures, or had been, I should say, about her, in opposing the Iranian state's policies towards women, and by nominating themselves over and over for presidency, even though the Iranian constitution may prohibit them from becoming presidents. But, you know, the ways, the creative ways through which Iranian women activists have been making major changes in the laws and the policies shows that they have found ways to navigate these kind of, you know, both the pressures from the Iranian state and the pressures from the kind of so-called liberating forces from outside.
One of the primary concerns that you raise in the book relates to the nature of dissent and what constitutes dissent online as well as offline, and there is and that there are certain limits to dissent when it comes to counterpublics. Could this question be related to diasporic digital cyber activism, gender, and the nature of politics and security in the United States?
Yeah, of course. Again, you know, what constitutes dissent is very complicated, because, again, if we only focus and kind of obsessed with the state as the oppressive force, then the only kind of legitimate dissent becomes that to, in the context of Iran, for example, to the Iranian state. Whereas, you know, in the realm of also cyberspace, thinking about how cyberspace can be or, you know, say internet or social media can be used to defy the state, in a sense, ignores the fact that One, the state also uses social media and multiple states in the U.S. or elsewhere, and how internet can and is a site of securitization, and how all of these pose limits to what it means to think of internet as the realm, the realm of dissent. And again, we can also think about how logics of nationalism, global capitalism, are reproduced in a sense in cyberspace, and that there isn't this kind of clear divide between online and offline, that these two constantly form each other and are informed by each other. So there is, you know, this idea of internet as the line of flight, or as, you know, where basically dissent becomes possible, is, I think, if in the 90s that was big in the realm of, you know, cyber enthusiasts, I think it has proven itself to be a fantasy or a fallacy in a sense. And of course, we can think about in the context of the U.S., not just techniques of surveillance that are enabled by the kind of internet technologies, but also the way that, again, the logic of cyber, in a sense, clicktivism has become so big that just by pressing a button, you know, you think you're making a change in the world, where that's not necessarily the case. This is not to say that internet has not enabled or facilitated organizing for many communities in the U.S. or transnational. I mean, we saw that in, you know, during the Arab Spring. But, you know, we have to take that with a grain of salt, because that is just one side of the story. And to assume that internet has enabled dissent, or that internet is where dissent begins, erases long histories of social movements, long histories of dissent and revolutions that precede the internet. So I think, in a sense, to approach the potentials of dissent on internet with caution is necessary.
Mm-hmm. I gathered from your book that the idea of democratic futurity as dominantly conceived in webloggistan was heteronormative. Do you think heteronormativity, neoliberal nationalism, and aspiration for democracy were co-constitutive, and how did they inform one another through digital citizenship?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, like you said, you know, if this idea of futurity in the context of webloggistan and political discussions around the politics of Iran very much relied on imagining, like I said before, an Iranianness, an ideal form of democratic Iranianness that repeated and reproduced heteronormative ideas of the nation, and also in its deployments and iterations of democracy, you know, the practices of kind of practicing democracy in webloggistan. It was very much, again, recentering of you know, heteropatriarchy in a sense. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but this form of futurity, or, you know, in the context of the future of Iran, imagining a democratic future in Iran, very much relied on heteronormativity. But you know, also, as I say, said before, you know, global capitalism, notions of modernity that are kind of produce on the assumptions or on the binaries of tradition and modernity in the context of Iran. I think I'm losing my terrain of thought there, but a different way of thinking about futurity, of course, is think in the context of the sanctions on Iran, how futurity is actually denied to Iranians altogether, because there is no kind of future democratic or not when we are thinking about a population that as a whole is subjected to a pending death under the deadly sanctions in Iran. So I'm sorry, I think I totally lost what you were asking. But I end the book by this kind of rather pessimistic notion of thinking about politics, not in relationship to kind of this optimistic futurity, thinking about those who do not have the privilege or the luxury of imagining that kind of futurity when their present is very much imbued with death under the sanctions.
Absolutely, yeah. As I was reading your book, I was also curious to know how you found community as a blogger and a researcher, and how did it influence your research and lead you to the critiques that you so powerfully present in your book?
Yeah, I, of course, when I was blogging, there was this really amazing sense of community with a group of bloggers, that I was following every day and reading their blogs and vice versa, kind of thinking about through the concept of Iranianness, of course, or the language. So there was definitely this sense of community. But as I say, there's this kind of romanticization of the notion of community that also becomes very much apparent when we think about the forms of exclusion and violence that come through the concept of community, that there isn't this form of horizontal comradeship, to quote Benedict Anderson's notion of imagined communities, but there are the same forms of inequalities of power that exist offline that are based on class, gender, location, citizenship, and so on and so forth, and language, that repeat themselves also in weblogistan. So I talk about a book called We Are Iran, which was about weblogistan, and it kind of produced this idea or the image of a community of Iranians that were united against the Iranian state, and how presumptuous that was, that, there were so many fights happening in weblogistan. There wasn't this kind of united front of bloggers, and that unfortunately, with the elections in 2005, when Mahmoud Ahmadinejad became the president, the far right conservative, it was kind of a wake up call to some of us who in weblogistan were reading each other's blogs, had this sense of community for a reformist candidate, Moin, at the time. And then, the election results was like a slap in the face that, no, we are not the microcosm of the Iranian population. And that sense of community is nice and comforting, but at the same time, it hinders forms of violence that happen in the name of community, and it hinders inequalities, and it also maybe in the context of weblogistan in particular, it becomes very limited to those who read each other, who respond to each other, who engage with each other. And while, again, it was hard for me to, after doing field work offline and online, to go back to writing because, or to kind of quit blogging because that sense of community was very comforting. But at the same time, you know, it's like I said, there are also aspects of notion of community that we need to think about more critically.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I think so much of what's written about communities is uncritical. You also write about necropolitics in terms of queer and trans death in the age of queer rights in the West, and how trans and queer deaths in Iran are speakable, while those in the West are not. Could you expand on what this necropolitical representation reveals about trans and queer lives and digital aspirational activism?
Sure, yeah. As you said, you know, there is this kind of hyper visibility of, in particular, trans Iranians as victims of torture in Iran, you know, and torture is basically the surgeries, the gender affirming surgeries that are called sex reassignment surgeries by some of these human rights organizations that consider these surgeries to be torture in Iran, are very much kind of hyper-visibilizing Iranian trans people as victims. And you know, the stories of trans death become very much speakable. But then when it comes to trans deaths, of Iranian trans refugees, or, you know, trans deaths of people of color in U.S. or Canada or Europe, they kind of you know, they're not as speakable as they are when they happen in a place like Iran, and that again shows how notions of life and death become deployed, and how this discrepancy of representation reveals the geopolitical aspect of queer and trans necropolitics, that you know, trans Iranians who die in, say, Canada, when they leave Iran as refugees and come to Canada, they're not spoken about, they're not talked about. The story is twisted again to make it about the kind of oppression of trans people in Iran. So this is not to say that trans people, in particular, we are talking about, of course, you know, when we talk about trans people in such general terms, other notions such as class or ethnicity become very much erased. When I talk about the trans, in particular trans women's stories that become hyper visible, they're mostly working class trans people. Like many other places in the world, if you have money, you can have a comfortable life as a trans person in Iran for, you know, for most people. But we are talking about working class trans women whose stories become kind of fetishized and hyper visible in US and European and, you know, Canadian media. You know, when it comes to actual value of life, there is, you know, there is definitely a hypocrisy there. And you can see that, you know, in my work on queer and trans refugees, I write about how trans and queer Iranian refugees in Turkey, for example, have been waiting for many, many years under the assumption that they're under the protection of human rights or refugee rights through UNHCR, but but at the same time, their lives are disposable. They don't have access to medical care. They don't have access to hormones for many people. So, it really depends on when one dies and where that kind of decides the kind of representability of trans death in these kind of narratives that reproduce the binary of freedom and lack thereof, or transphobia and trans rights in the transnational context.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you also note that blogging did not bring Iranian civil society into being, but it was merely an extension of a transnational civil society that already existed. Could you tell our audience a little bit about the role Iranian women played as agential actors, agential civil society actors, and in what ways did they resist the reproduction of gender exclusion in weblogistan?
One of the narratives that I saw when I was doing my research on representations of blogging was that the assumption that weblogistan was the site of civil society, or it was the first time civil society in Iran, in post-revolutionary Iran, had flourished, and where people were having dialogues and so on and so forth. And I spend a whole chapter of the book to talk about how civil society actually precedes, or the emergence of civil society in post-revolutionary Iran really precedes the emergence of weblogistan, and in particular post-89, post the Iran-Iraq war. there was the emergence of concept of Jamee Madani in the Iranian political realm, and how women have participated before and after the Iranian Revolution in 1979 in the realm of civil society. The Iranian women's participation both in the political realm and also in the kind of activist work that they have been doing is an example of that. And some of the examples I bring are the Iranian women activists who basically had a sit-in in front of the Iranian parliament right before the presidential elections, and the arrest of Iranian activists, Iranian women activists, and they're very firm and vocal kind of contestation to appropriation of their cause. Iranian women have worked very hard since the Iranian Revolution, after the laws changed, with restriction imposed on women's rights in Iran, how they have participated also in the higher education, the very high number of Iranian women who are in the universities and in higher education, and the kind of work that they have been doing in different realms, whether it's mosques or the social kind of social services, show that Iranian women have been a part of the Iranian civil society in very active ways since the Iranian Revolution. They're not victims. They're not those who are just stuck at home. The assumption that Iranian women did not have a voice before the emergence of the internet, again, is very much false. That, Iranian women have been very much vocal in their contestations to the state, and in kind of both providing services in realms that may not appear in our definitions of what constitutes proper politics. Again, like I said, women's jalousies, women's gatherings, whether it's religious gatherings or literary gatherings and so on and so forth show that Iranian women have been a part of these conversations.
That's extremely nuanced and thought-provoking. Thank you for that answer. I realize we are nearing the end of this interview, but before we end, would you like to tell us what you're currently working on?
Sure. If you want me to be quite honest, I'm on my sabbatical now. I'm working on my backyard. I'm building a patio myself, which is quite refreshing to use part of my sabbatical to do some physical work. And I think it's important to kind of have a balance between the academic work and doing other things. But my academic work, which I assume what your question is about, on my second book, which really focuses on, queer and trans death, some of the articles I have published are kind of working to that direction, to think about queer and trans refugees and notions of killability, Lone's Life, which I kind of introduced briefly in the book Politics of Rightful Killing, a kind of life that is contingent on the benevolence of human rights, but at the same time, it can be taken away at any time if it doesn't fit, it doesn't kind of abide to the expectations of what it means to live a democratic and free life. That is what I'm thinking about and looking at also diasporic Iranian queer and trans organizations and their participation in these forms of politics of rightful killing. And I'm also interested in the way that how we even think about life and death and human life and human death and what that might mean in terms of abstraction of notions of life and death. So thinking through queer and trans life and death, I also want to complicate what kind of life we are talking about and what kind of death we are talking about, to kind of go beyond the abstractions of notions of life, death, and being.
Yeah, that's absolutely urgent and so important. I remember your work on queer death in sexualities, which, if I'm not mistaken, was published in 2014, and it was extremely generative and made me rethink many of my own assumptions about queer rights and politics in the West. And I'm just thankful that your book, in a way, became an extension of that work and also explores further some of the concerns you raised in that article. Thank you so much, Seema, again, for being here and for your book and for your scholarship.
Janine, and thank you for your kind words about that article. And I'm so humbled and glad to hear that it was generative and it kind of contributed to how you think about queer rights. And I very much look forward to reading your work and to what you will be producing during your graduate career. And thank you again for taking the time to talk to me about the book.